So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight. Oh.
Listen to Review Man.
The Triple Header. It's a game of Jeopardy. For the first time in World Wrestling Federation history, all three titles will be contested in one single match. The WWF Champion, Big Daddy Cool Diesel, joins forces with his best friend, the Intercontinental Champion, Shawn Michaels. Their opponents, Yokozuna and Owen Hart. Perhaps the greatest WWF tag team champions ever. Tonight, for the two dudes with attitudes, the reward for success is high. If victorious, they'll add the tag team titles to their collection. But the price of failure is equally great. A defeat will cost one of these champions his title. Tonight, it's a match that will test not only the true mettle of a champion, but the bond between friends as well. Tonight, loyalty as well as prestige are precariously up for grabs because someone's gonna lose their gold.
Welcome to Review Away. It's John Pollock and Wei Ting, where this week, Wei, we are going to be reviewing wrestling.
Yeah.
As which we almost do every week, except for anniversary specials.
That's true. Although, last week had many ties to professional wrestling.
Yes, it was definitely, I guess, by extension, a pro wrestling review. But how did you feel afterwards, Wei? You went into that review, I think, with a little leery, but after all was said and done, what did you think? We got quite a lot of feedback to that
show.
How
did I feel?
Were you happy with how the show went last week?
I felt absolutely violated.
Oh, well, I bet China felt the same way.
Yeah, I felt violated by all of you, all these people, forcing me basically by gunpoint.
Oh, by gunpoint.
By poll.
King of hyperbole here, Wei Ting.
To watch this filth. I did it. I'm not happy. I did it. But, yeah, whatever. It's over.
Wei, what are your thoughts on this new Korean sensation that has swept the nation?
What are you talking about?
The Psy? What's his name? Does anyone know his name?
I don't know.
For all the 200 million views that he got?
I have no idea. I just found out about this thing this weekend. I'd heard all about whatever that fucking song, Gundam, whatever it is. And I eventually decided to watch it.
I don't think that's it. But there is something called Gundam Style. I think this is it.
Whatever.
We are so detached from the pop culture world.
I don't get it. I think it's stupid.
What's it called? Oh, fuck it. 200 million views on I think it's peaked already, though. His appearance on Saturday Night Live, I think it's jumped the shark in, like, almost record fashion. Like, this only came to my attention last Wednesday, and by Sunday morning, it's like, okay, we got it.
Yeah, I mean, I watched like a minute, and I shut it off. I don't understand why.
It's like the danger of something so preposterous having such a gigantic popularity that it's impossible, I think, to follow it up with anything sustainable in your career. That this guy 10 years from now, you said it before, it's the Baja Men of 2012. And no one can tell me a follow-up song they ever put out.
It is the Carly Rae Jepsen of September as opposed to August.
I hope that we've heard the last of Carly Rae Jepsen, but I do worry about her. That's what I said. I remember when Christina Aguilera came out with Genie in a Bottle, and I was convinced this would be her one and only song, and here we are 13 years later, and I'm still hearing Christina Aguilera.
I have no doubt that maybe in Korea, this guy is probably going to become some kind of legend. I don't know if there's ever been a Korean act that has, I guess, breached the mainstream like this guy.
Yeah, he's eclipsed Kim Jong-il, I guess, in terms of a worldwide figure.
Do you know any other Koreans aside from Psy and Kim Jong-il? Is that why you bring
Andrew, who I went to elementary school with,
okay.
And
Gail Kim.
Gail Kim. And that would be about it. You know what? I'm sure... I mean, there's lots of people, though, of Asian descent that you don't typically know where in Asia they are from. I'm sure we know lots of Koreans. I don't go up to people when I meet them. I was like, so are you Japanese? Are you Korean?
You can't tell?
No, I can't. I don't have a perception to decipher.
Wow. Okay, that explains.
I'm sure you've been a victim of this many a time.
Yeah, I can't tell either, to be honest with
Konnichiwa.
Yeah.
As one MMA trainer infamously said hello to you.
I get that all the time.
That was the best. Kevin Kearns.
Yeah. Kevin Kearns. Kenny Florian's.
That was the day of your infamous shoot with Kenny Florian, the Zoolander one.
That is correct.
Some of your best work.
Oh, thank you.
It's never coming back, ever?
No, never say never, but I don't know.
There's such a demand in the MMA community for that.
Yeah, by who?
Ariel Helwani and David Loiseau are at the top of the list of people who want the weigh-in back. John Pollock is a third. I don't know if I'm a pillar in the MMA community like those two, but I feel that the weigh-in would be really your rocket to the top.
It was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun when I did it, but I don't know. I feel like I've matured. I feel like I've grown.
I disagree. Who is your favorite person to talk to? Because for those that are not familiar with the weigh-in, it was a segment that Wei used to do for Fight Network, and they would be online. You can search the weigh-in, spelled W-A-I, and he would interview non-fighters, athletes, actors, artists, and turn it into an MMA interview. And there were sometimes you interviewed Gina Carano. And anyway, it just turned in its way interviewing people who have no idea about MMA, about MMA. So who were some of your favorites?
Some of my favorites. I would definitely say Gina Carano was a lot of fun. She
was into it.
She was
Kenny Florian.
Well, the thing about all these is that the way we would be able to get access is obviously because we work for the Fight Network, so these guys would be coming in to do interviews anyway. And what would allow me to do my stupid interviews with these people is that we would have people like John Pollock who would first step up and do the real serious interview and would get them in a good mood, because I remember Kenny Florian, especially at that time, he was just not really in the mood to talk much whatsoever.
Oh, that's right.
But then like you had an excellent chat with him and you really opened him up. And then you're like, can Wei just do a quick little thing with him? And then I
shot that. I remember. I was so nervous about shooting and fucking up. I had no qualms about doing the interview. Like no worry about that. To me, it was, fuck, I don't want to fuck up Wei's segment here and shoot it and screw something up. That was my only concern that day. I was very nervous.
You did fine. But then I would come in and I would just. So, Kenny, I just need you to read these Ben Stiller lines. And he's like, what? Oh, okay. And he would do it. And
he was into it.
He got into it by the end. Yeah, he did a Zoolander for me.
I thought it was so brilliant because so many fighters, it's like they tell me the same thing. It's like and it's something I'm conscious of when I interview them, is that they do so many interviews where they're asked so many similar questions. And I don't really like asking guys about how your training camp went, and I mean sometimes, unfortunately, those are questions you just kind of get cornered into talking about when guys are not that talkative. But you want to ask questions that people are, that they're not. They do 10 million interviews, and I guarantee you, Kenny Florian remembers your interview as opposed to 500 others that he's done discussing fights and discussing training. They like a break from the norm. So
perhaps, yeah.
It was a great interview. So you interviewed Tim Robbins, which was hilarious.
Yeah, I feel bad about that, actually.
Who was the person you upset? Neil Young, you interviewed at a golf course, wasn't it?
No, it was not Neil Young. It was Tom Cochran.
Tom Cochran, that's right.
Yeah, so a lot of these. And you know what? The reason why we're able to just do that is because we used to have a producer who worked here, Dave Rutherford, and he had great connections from the sports world. He used to work at The Score, and so he would always get these invites to these charity events and whatnot featuring celebrities. And like from our standpoint, it's just like, well, we're probably going to talk to this guy once and never again on the Fight Network, so why not just
even if we rub them the wrong Wei, who cares?
Yeah, so I went in there to just fuck with them, really, and it was fun. It was
a lot of
fun.
I think the majority enjoyed it. Tim Robbins did not like it, but You got it on camera.
So. Oh, Kathleen Robertson from 90210.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, Steve Sanders should go check that in interview out with Kathleen Robertson.
Yeah.
Claire.
Yeah, she I don't think she really enjoyed it. Probably not very memorable for her.
Yeah, but whatever. Yeah. And I'm just all these weigh-in memories coming back. The night we went to the it was the night of the federal election, and we went to the NDP's setup they had at the government. And you upset a politician so much. Remember that one guy?
Yeah,
who was,
he was an NDP guy.
He's like a local councillor, I think.
Yeah, I forget his name.
Go search right now on the YouTube, The Weigh-In, W-A-I, and just all the videos are there, and check them out, because it's really some comedic gold from Wei Ting.
Well, thank you.
And that takes us way to the night of September the 24th, 1995.
I don't know the relation whatsoever. I don't know how we got from there to Detroit.
Well, because
1995.
The federal election was September 24th of 2008. No, it wasn't. I'm lying. Dan Lavransky was laughing at my date thing. He was like, listen to the FMW podcast. He's like, that's fucked that you can do that date thing. I mean, that's weird.
You're like a mutant.
Yeah, an Irish mutant.
Yeah.
Like Seamus. And this in your houseway, I was not aware here. 95 is generally considered like the low point of the World Wrestling Federation over the past 25 years. From, you know, they were dying at the box office at this time, like really doing.
Box office?
Yeah.
Do they have those?
Well, I mean, the figurative box office at the gate.
Like, okay, okay.
They were not doing very well. However, looking back at some of their pay-per-view numbers in 95, very healthy by today's standards, actually. And they're in way more homes now with pay-per-view capability than 1995. They didn't have international distribution for pay-per-views at this point. And they were still doing like 250,000, 300,000 buys for shows. And that was considered poor at the time, which today, that's a great number for a B-show.
Well, at that time, there was no such thing as the internet. Or at least piracy on the internet that
it
didn't
was
exist.
Pro Wrestling Illustrated or bust if you were a 11-year-old John Pollock.
That's right, and there was also much less pro wrestling available on TV. You didn't get 2-hour Raws, you didn't get 3-hour Raws, and you didn't get pay per views.
At this time in Canada, all you had was Superstars. Mm-hmm. There was, I guess, if you had TBS, you could get WCW Saturday Night, but I didn't get TBS at this time, all I had was Superstars.
No Nitro.
No Nitro yet. That was actually Nitro would have just started in the U.S. when this was 3 weeks after Nitro debuted. But yeah, in Canada, we did not get Nitro till I think like 96. And that was, of course, as we mentioned before, on a 6-day delay.
Mm-hmm.
Just a completely different world. And I think that's why I think fans that grew up at that time where you had to work so hard to seek things out, I think you do appreciate the accessibility today because it's so polar opposite from that point. There's where everything is accessible right now. You miss a show, you find it online right away. Everything is at your fingertips. There's so much to watch. There's so much information that's readily available.
You say appreciate, but I think it's gotten to the point where it's become a detriment because there's just too much of it to keep up with. And even if you wanted to... There's just more supply than there is demand, in my opinion, for professional
wrestling.
You had
to work back in that day to acquire your wrestling fix. You had to go quite the extra step. I mean, this was 11 years old. I was likely watching this pay-per-view via Scramble Vision.
Yeah.
I did that for years.
You
and
did, huh?
I really questioned my psyche of, like, what a idiot I was. But to me, it was like my parents were not going to get pay-per-view. The idea of spending $30 to watch TV was completely foreign to them. They were like, not a chance.
Mm-hmm.
And I would watch it with my brother until my brother, like my younger brother, was like, John, this is really dumb. It's like we would put the TV on and then we'd kind of just like leave it on in the background. It's not like we were sitting on a couch like looking at the screen. I mean, that would probably ruin my vision. But nonetheless, that was what I did for every WWF pay-per-view.
Uh-huh.
And then I would go to school on Monday morning and I was like an 11-year-old Dave Meltzer with all my friends coming up and asking me what happened on the pay-per-view that night. And then me and this other guy who was a wrestling fan, we became competition for who had the wrestling information.
Wow.
Because he did not do the scramble vision, but he called Starphone to get the results.
Oh.
So it was like the Observer and the Torch in 11-year-old form in grade 5 at Blessed Trinity Elementary School.
Well, I would trust you more. You would have a first-hand account.
Yeah. I would break down the psychology and...
Via scramble vision.
Yeah, and then give my star ratings on... Well, it sounded like a 3.5-star match.
Oh, wow.
Anyway, but that's how you to work for things. It's like you take it for granted now. We watch like a pay-per-view almost twice a month,
mm-hmm.
multiple times with MMA shows. It's a completely different world going back to 95. But, way, in my extremely long tangent there, this was a time period when a lot of fans had tuned out. Wei Ting was tuning in.
Yeah, this was really... Watching this show was a pleasure because this was really the time that I was... the biggest mark of my life, I suppose. I was a huge, huge fan of Brett at this time, and even though this was after his longest or one of his real run as champion around WrestleMania 10, he was still a very big focal point of the show, and I just remember watching and remembering all these characters that ended up being absolutely nothing. For example, Waylon Mercy. For example, Jean-Pierre Lafitte.
Lafitte. Even at 11, I really started to turn on the like 95. If I had to categorize a time period as a child where I was closest to just giving up, and I did start skipping like shows, it was 95 because mm-hmm. it was at this point my brother stopped watching wrestling, and to me it was the two of us would always watch together. And when he stopped watching, I started to think, well, maybe this is kind of dumb to keep following this wrestling stuff. And it was like the gimmicks got so goofy, like even at 11. And that's where I go back to this, the audience right now. And it's like, well, it's a lot of child-friendly gimmicks. They're trying to market to a younger audience. And I remember at 11 when they were trying to market to a younger audience. And I hated this stuff. I thought it was pandering to the utmost here. It was like I didn't want a garbage man. I didn't want a guy like T.L. Hopper that was picking up chocolate bars in a pool that were supposed to be disguised as turds or pirates stealing jackets. I hated this stuff at 11, and it's just because this is considered PG doesn't mean that the child audience likes this shit,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So, anyway, that was my bone of contention with 95, but this was a show. I've never watched this show before. I've probably heard it, but I had never seen it. And all the titles are on the line in the main event here. With Diesel, the WWF champion at the time, teaming with Intercontinental champion Shawn Michaels to take on the tag champions, the British, Owen Hart and Yokozuna.
Mm-hmm.
And we would get a bit of a swerve here in the main event, but only three titles here. And this was a big deal at the time. All the titles on the line in one match. And I remember this was a big deal because the setup, it was guaranteed there would be a title change. And a title change was huge at this point in time.
It was because
I don't think there had ever been a title. There hadn't been. This was only the third in your house. And it was like you don't see title changes on an in your house event. And I think it was a full like year and a half before there was an actual title change on an in your house event, because these were secondary shows. They were priced at like $15. They were only 2 hours. They were essentially like a Sunday night house show where they would do 4 or 5 matches on pay-per-view. And then they'd do another 3 or 4 matches for the live crowd. And the whole thing, only 2 hours would air on pay-per-view, and then the last hour was for the live audience.
That's right. Did they stop giving houses away by this point?
Yes. This was not a... There was a funny story involving that first In Your House, which we should review one day, where they gave away a house.
I feel like we have.
We didn't review that first one, don't think. And I believe the story was the kid and his... mom who won the house ended up like defaulting on payments and had to like get rid of the house or something. It's like you won the house, but it's not like your mortgage was paid for or anything. It was like it was weird. You got to Google this stuff, and it
makes no sense. You're supposed to have the house paid for
entirely. I don't think it was paid for in full. It was like it was like an Oprah gift.
Well, what I didn't really get was that did you does that mean you have to move to wherever the house is. You have to pack your bags. You have to quit your job.
It was a new spinoff. Evicted from your house was a new giveaway.
Yeah. Did you get to watch the Sunday Night Slam that preceded this?
No, I didn't. So what happened on Sunday Night Slam? Because I had the VHS copy of this, which did not contain the pre-show, but it did have the video game strategies at the end of the video.
Oh, that's right.
Hosted by Todd Pettengill.
You can inform me about that. But on Sunday Night Slam, which was really their preview channel, half-hour pre-show, we didn't really get too much that was different. Just a recap of all the angles. We had a recap of the Dean Douglas and Razor Ramon angle. This was to be Dean Douglas's first pay-per-view appearance. Dean Douglas, of course, Shane Douglas in his brief stint in the WWF. And, just a recap of the angles, which we'll go through later. Recap of the Bret and Jean-Pierre Lafitte angle. And a promo from two dudes with attitudes. So, and they say that, a promo with Jim Cornette and Owen and Yoko talking about the two dudes with attitudes. And Cornette, as always, is great. He says that instead of two dudes with attitudes, you're going to be two fellas who are yellow.
Yellow.
Yeah.
WWE.com here conducted an interview with the house winner back in May of this year.
Oh, wow.
And here's your question. First thing, are you still living in the home? And Matthew Pompaselli, no, I don't own the house. I sold it about 6 months after I won it. We had just moved from New York to Las Vegas, and it was a big decision to move into the Florida home, rent it or sell it. It was a tough choice, but selling it meant I'd have money for college. WWE Magazine, wow, an 11-year-old flipping real estate. How much did you bank from the sale? I believe it was sold for more than 175 grand, which back then was good money for an 11-year-old. How did it feel when you actually realized you had won? It was surreal. I had filled out the form, and about 3 days before the event, my dad put it in the mail. We ordered the pay-per-view that night, and they dug out one envelope out of about 340,000 and made the phone call to the winner. They dial, and my phone does not ring. Turns out they had the wrong numbers. They redial, and a minute later, my phone rings. My dad gets on, and I can hear his New York accent booming through the TV. I'm screaming in the background, like blood-curdling screams. He says he got instant popularity status at school. I don't know. There was a story going around that he was like, I don't know. It doesn't sound as rosy as this interview depicts on it from WWE Magazine. But anyway, Matthew Pompaselli. Yeah. Making money off of this house.
That'd be really silly to expect somebody to move just because they want a house. I mean, no, not exactly.
You did enter the contest, though.
Well, I mean, I think they would be expecting somebody to sell that home rather than pack up their entire lives and leave.
Well, one and done for this company of giving away houses.
It's a nice idea.
In your house.
Yeah.
Give away a house. Anyway, so that was the pre-show.
That was a pre-show. Not too much
it. Not too much. So we started off, I always enjoy mid-90s animation logos, and for this one, the In Your House logo knocks on the door of a house and cannot get in, so it pulls up a ladder and breaks into the house, and as it goes into the window, the shot goes into the arena in
wow.
Saginaw, Michigan. Quite the animation here for In Your House.
Yeah, well, this was the same year that Toy Story came out, wasn't it? Around the
95, yeah, I think so.
So, yeah, computer
maybe
graphics all the rage.
They were hiring some Pixar executives to work on In Your House.
Maybe. Actually, for its time, this was pretty good.
Is In Your House Pixar? Is
it Disney? No way. In Your House?
No. Toy Story.
Oh, yeah.
It was Pixar, right?
Of course. Okay. Yeah.
The announcers for this show, Vince McMahon, Jim Ross, and Jerry the King Lawler. And they get predictions at the start. Lawler predicts Owen Hart will win the IC title tonight, pinning Shawn Michaels, while Jim Ross predicts Yokozuna will win the WWF title.
Jerry Lawler says this is the biggest triple header in Michigan since the Supremes came into town.
Oh, wow. And they got the Supremes, I guess, for the In Your House theme.
Yes, it was just they didn't actually get the Supremes,
no.
But it was a Motown version of the In Your House theme. Because, like, in the past, they would use, like, this really shitty country or rock thing.
Pow, 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 In Your House. They had a rap one, so
They
had a rap one.
I like it. I liked it. I liked the different styles. Way better than Saliva.
Yeah. We kick things off with Way's favorite character, Waylon Mercy. Dan Spivey, for those that remember, from the Skyscrapers and you know, kind of this fringe character in the mid-80s in the WWF that went to WCW, competed in Japan, and then probably most remembered, though, for this brief gimmick where it was like he was...
Explain this gimmick, John. I'd like to hear how somebody would explain this.
He was like a Jimmy Buffett-style character. I don't know.
Hello, all you people. It's old Waylon Mercy again. As you can tell, I'm out here at the park, around the picnic area, waiting for all the people to come in. Surely after a while, they'll be out here with their children, with their fried chicken and potato salads and some hot dogs. Surely some hamburgers to go along with all that stuff. And the kids, they'll be running around here having a good old time. And then after a while, the kids will get on the parents' nerves, and the parents will start yelling and screaming. And then load up everything, put the children in the back daggum seats. Then they'll go home, and then they'll tell all their families and friends what a great time they had at the park and what a great picnic it was. Well, let me tell you something. Waylon Mercy knows how to throw a good picnic. And when I get into the ring in the WWF, I want to show you people what a picnic is all about. You know what I mean?
He's just like, creep. That's the gimmick. Be creepy.
He killed bugs on his forearm.
He had jet black hair in a skullet, almost. And he wears Hawaiian shirts. And his music is like this, like almost like kind of like a serene type of thing.
This is what they were going for, I think.
Oh, okay, like a jet black haired Jimmy Buffett, but more creepier, way creepier. He had like this weird tattoo like on his forehead. His real picture.
Life has not been kind to Dangerous Dan.
Did he not pass away?
No. He's alive. Way.
Oh,
he is alive. Yeah, this is the gimmick he's probably most well remembered for. He had this weird tattoo on his forehead, this fake tattoo on his arm. What the hell did it read?
Anyway.
A terrible gimmick at the time, but...
I thought it was kind of cool, just, on the outset. Like, as far as...
It was different, it was creepy, and a heel. So.
It was not a garbage man or something like that, or teacher.
No. And taking on Savio Vega, who had just debuted earlier this year at In Your House. And they showed highlights of this with Savio Vega saving Razor Ramon, his buddy, from Jeff Jarrett and Road Dogg. And Dan Spivey, Waylon Mercy, his catchphrase was, "If you know what I mean." And he came out to this weird piano music.
Yeah.
Very strange.
Yeah.
Vega got control of his left arm early on. Mercy hit a scoop slam. Vince McMahon here had one of his best near fall calls of all time. It was like,
"I cover here. We got one, two, and yes, no,
yes, we do.
No, we don't.
Only a count of two.
He's got him. No. He's got him. No, he hasn't. No.
In rare form, Vince McMahon, the man I enjoy once in a while when we review these shows on commentary. Yeah. Doc Hendricks is in the back, Michael Hayes, with late breaking news stating that Owen Hart is not in the building yet. After you have purchased this pay-per-view. So, if you bought this for the main event, you were getting a late replacement. Glad UFC doesn't do this.
Fans would be pissed. They don't. They would probably suspend the...
Vitor Belfort is not here at the Air Canada Center.
Yeah.
And we are going to have to find another member to be the challenger tonight.
It kind of has happened with Kimbo Slice and Shamrock. Remember that?
That's true.
That was a last-minute thing.
That was free, though. And that turned out well worth tuning in for a surreal night of MMA.
Oh, that was just awful.
Seth Petruzzelli. I remember that night, how the Monday after, everyone was like, wow, Kimbo was this huge star. Now Seth Petruzzelli is going to be, he beat the big star. And it was like these people with this flawed logic that you beat the big star and suddenly you gain all of his charisma and his drawing power. It's like, that's not how... Star-making works in this business, and that is why Seth Petruzzelli was fighting on Spike.com last week on a K1 show that no one watched. Mm. And Kimbo Slice could probably still fight today in MMA and draw an audience.
Yeah.
Anyway, Vega hit a big boot, standing heel kick for a two count, and then Waylon Mercy hits a brainbuster, and Jim Ross, almost in mocking fashion, "Vince, that's a brainbuster." Just almost like pointing out that Vince had no idea what to call this. Mm. What a maneuver. And Vega then hits a bridging German suplex for a two count and then comes back with a spinning heel kick. And Savio Vega pins Waylon Mercy clean 7 minutes and 7 seconds. And Waylon Mercy this was his first pay-per-view. And Savio Vega beats him clean. So however long he had been on TV, I guess the company not too high on Waylon Mercy.
Obviously not. Losing clean in his debut.
And this was really, he did not have a long run. This was his, I think, only pay-per-view with the company and was quickly let go.
Yeah. I wonder why.
Just didn't connect. This was like his last big exposure.
Hmm.
Dan Spivey. Gorilla Monsoon is in the back arguing with Jim Cornette, who had his faction of Camp Cornette with Owen, Yokozuna, British Bulldog. And Cornette says that Owen will be here tonight in Saginaw, and Doc Hendricks here, confused, calling Gorilla Monsoon Jim. And then Monsoon says the match will happen tonight, regardless. Like, really? The guy isn't here.
So
we were getting a different main event, it looked like.
Hmm.
Set up for the next main event, it was Henry Godwin taking on Psycho Sid, and this match was put together after Henry Godwin dropped his slop onto Ted DiBiase, and then he took a powerbomb from Sid onto the floor, onto the mat.
Yeah, yeah.
Exciting match here. Psycho Sid and Henry Godwin. Henry O. Godwin. Hog.
Hog, that's right.
Later team up with Pig.
Yeah, Phineas. I got one. But DiBiase here was managing Sid at the time, and he was slopped multiple times, and thus, this was time for revenge.
Time for revenge on In Your House. And we got a close-up here of the slop of Henry Godwin's. What do you think this was? This looked like some
chunky soup.
Yeah.
I would imagine.
Yeah.
Whatever they had in catering mixed into some broth.
Yeah. Some weird concoction here. That's the question I would ask Henry Godwin of how they put together this slop.
You think they ever, like, you know, would, as a rib, put in, like, real, like,
feces?
Shit? Yeah.
Maybe.
Like, if there's, like, we're going to slop Sonny today. All right. Guys, chip in. Here you go. Pass the bucket around.
This is not a company that was ever, I guess, tame when it came to ribs on people they did not care for.
Yeah.
Ask Sable or Amy Weber, who was one of those Diva Search girls who got the real RKO. I don't know what that means, but she does. Anyway, Ross notes that neither of these men are technical purists, and this may have been the first ever time he used the term slobber knocker.
This is going to be who's the toughest, because this is going to be a stand-up slobber knocker here.
A what?
A slobber knocker.
To the outside.
It ain't going to be pretty.
Has been hammered.
That's the more of that Oklahoma jargon.
Could have, because
it sounded like he just made it up on the spot, and Lawler and Vince were both confused by this term.
I'm sure he's used it before in his career. I mean, this sounds like something that you don't just come up on the spot here. Slobber
Maybe
knocker.
He's been perfecting it in his mind for months.
But
someone point out to us if he had used slobber knocker. Find a clip or something.
I want some
proof. I don't want some, no, you're wrong, Pollock, which is what I always get. I want video proof.
Nonetheless, he probably did not use it at all back then. And to the surprise of Jerry Lawler, slobber what? What? With some of that Oklahoma speak.
Sid drives his knee to the back and sends Henry to the floor. And then DiBiase is stomping on Henry. Sid then hits a running boot into the corner and then uses a cross face with his hands pulling at the face of Henry. Then, what came here? Camel clutch by Sid, a boot to the gut. And then Henry Godwin made his comeback here, hit the slop drop, which was an inverted DDT. DiBiase pulls Henry out, and then DiBiase gets chased after. Sid catches Henry on the apron, and then Godwin hits a bunch of punches, gets tripped by Ted DiBiase as he runs the ropes, and Sid hits a leg drop and then the power bomb for the clean win at 7 minutes and 23 seconds. And they go to use the slop after, but Bam Bam Bigelow runs in to make the save. And then Kama runs down. Kama, the supreme fighting machine, which was the WWE's idea to capitalize on the UFC with the SFC, Kama. That was their idea at the time. He was their shoot fighter. And they would do these mythical fantasy matchups every month in WWF Magazine where it would be Kama against, like, a boxer or Sylvester Stallone, and they'd come up with all these fantasy matchups.
Do you hear that?
Yeah.
The hell was that?
It's,
Oh, we got fire alarms happening in the office. Sorry about that.
Well,
if we die, we die.
One of his more successful gimmicks.
I'd say probably the least remembered of Charles Wright's gimmicks.
Probably wasn't even his best gimmick as Kama. He had multiple gimmicks while he was called Kama. He later became Kama Mustafa.
Mm-hmm. So how does that work? He's a supreme fighting machine who also was very proud.
Wore a white shirt underneath his singlet.
Yeah.
Menacing.
Not very.
I think he was really modeled after Kimo.
Perhaps, okay.
Very similar look. And
Like maybe a Zangief.
Maybe a combination of both.
Yeah.
I'm sure Vince was playing his Street Fighter at the time. And
maybe.
Who the fuck's this guy with a cross? Could have given him a cross, maybe. Come down to the ring with. Remember when Kimo brought the cross down after he beat Hoist? He lost to Hoist Gracie, but then Hoist was so injured that he could not continue, and Kimo spun it into a victory.
He's never seen a UFC.
From there, after the match, as we mentioned, Kama runs down to hold Bigelow away, and then Henry gets the slop, and...
DiBiase is about to...
Slop
to
Bigelow.
To pour the slop on Bigelow, but before he can, Godwin sneaks up behind him, and again, DiBiase is slopped for a third time.
And DiBiase sold this huge.
I thought this was very funny. It was just, I don't know, a nice Three Stooges type of scenario, where finally this guy is going to get his revenge, but then ends up slopping himself. And the crowd popped big for this slop. Just, you know, fine. The match was shit, as you would expect, between Sid and Henry O. Godwin. But the post-match was just good comedy for kids.
Yeah, I thought DiBiase was great here selling the slop, so that was good. After the match, Hendricks is once again in the back with Gorilla and Jim Cornette. Monsoon says the match is official, whether Owen shows up or not, and Cornette can either have Yokozuna defend the titles by himself, or he can find a tag partner, and Gorilla Monsoon will sanction that man for one night only to be one half of the tag team champions. And Jim Cornette is sent into a frenzy here.
It seemed to me like, watching this, like deals like this were a much bigger... They treated it with much more respect than what we get these days, and maybe that's just, you know, because we get title matches every single week now. But back then, something like this was treated with a lot of severity, I thought.
It was, because, I mean, the titles were over at this point, and as much as you can look at business being up and down, they protected those titles a lot. They kind of had to, because there was really... It was a byproduct of the Monday Night Wars, where television ratings became this big emphasis. At this time, no one cared about television ratings because these guys came from the school of thought that television and wrestling was designed to drive people to spend money on the product and not simply worry about advertising dollars or appeasing a network and getting paid for television content. It's a completely different animal at the time, and I would say it made for a stronger business model, but everything is so different now. The WWE makes so much money now off of licensing their television shows that the television is a major part of the show. But I like this at the part where these titles, I guarantee you there's a lot of fans who could probably recite to you the world champions from, you know, Hulk Hogan onwards right up until the last couple of years where it gets really foggy over the last decade.
But even in just the attention to detail of getting a gorilla, an official out there to make these rulings and have them seem way more serious and not just off the top of their heads, I think makes for better storytelling and overall better, more captivating title matches.
They pan through the crowd. Some guy in the front row had a sign that said, Lindsay... Would you go out with me? I'm venturing to guess the answer was no. This guy who was by himself in the front row at In Your House.
You don't think Lindsay was watching In Your
House?
I
don't think Lindsay was in her house at this time. She was probably out of her house with this guy's friend.
Hmm.
They replay the British Bulldog's heel turn from Raw, where the Bulldog turned on Diesel and power slammed him, and out of his hatred now for the fans, he cut his hair.
Ooh. Yeah.
New look for the British Bulldog here, the heel. And that takes us to the British Bulldog against Bam Bam Bigelow. Bam Bam Bigelow was probably not in the best of spirits here. He had worked the big match with Lawrence Taylor at WrestleMania that year, put him over, and at the time it was believed because of him working with Lawrence Taylor and, you know, putting over the outsider, he was going to get a big push coming out of WrestleMania. And unfortunately, he was always someone that was categorized as one of the victims of the clique at the time, who they did not care for this guy. And here we go, months later, he is working British Bulldog in the third match at In Your House, number three. And Bigelow had this weird instrumental theme at this time. He didn't come out to his usual
bam,
that you is synonymous with the character. He had this like weird remix. Didn't work for me. Anyway, they plug Bulldog's match coming up the next night on Raw against The Undertaker.
Wow. A rare appearance by The Undertaker, I guess.
On television, not on the pay-per-view.
By today's standards.
They show Cornette in the back talking to Psycho Sid about possibly teaming with Yokozuna. And it was funny because they showed all these different guys being offered this spot here. And I don't know if, like, Sid and Mabel, maybe they were... They trained with Greg Jackson and couldn't take this title fight on short notice, but why would they not accept this? The opportunity to be tag champion for one night and get a shot at being world champion. Why would you turn that down?
Obviously, they were living in some fear of the clique at this point. They didn't want to go up against Shawn and Diesel and have them push.
The political ramifications.
Oh, yeah.
So, the match begins, and Bulldog locks on a rear chin lock after Bigelow missed an elbow drop. We saw a series of clotheslines from Bigelow. Misses Bulldog and falls over the top to the floor. And then they battle for a vertical suplex on the apron with Bulldog dropping Bulldog on the top rope, crotch first. And then Bulldog clips the knee of Bigelow and works over the knee. Lawler discusses his beeper going off during this match and saying it could be Jim Cornette contacting him via beeper. Remember beepers?
Did you ever have a beeper?
I got one for Christmas one year, but I never activated it. Oh. It's like, I have a cell phone. Why would I want a beeper?
Somebody gave you a beeper after you already had a cell phone.
I think so. I can't remember which came first. But I remember. I just beepers to me. It's like, what an unnecessary middleman here in contacting someone. Like, okay, I got a beeper with the number. Now I have to go find a phone to call them back.
Well, before there were cell phones, I totally understood the point. You wanted to be in contact with people, yet you didn't have a phone with you. It's like, it's like a text.
I once knew this girl who, she had her cell phone one day and was just so sick of people calling her one day, she threw it into, like, the lake here in Toronto. Just took the phone and threw it into a lake.
Well, that's dumb.
Yeah, that's kind of strange.
You couldn't hit the off button on the phone?
I know. Hadn't heard of silent mode, I guess. Anyway, Bigelow then comes back with an enziguri, bunch of rest spots, and then Bigelow gets up, misses a moonsault off the top, and then Bulldog gets him up for, I guess, what was kind of a power slam to this large man, and gets the win. 12 minutes and 1 second. So British Bulldog was the new heel here they were pushing.
Wow,
beeper's going off. Maybe it's Jim Cornette.
Maybe it is.
This isn't annoying at all.
No. We're going to have to bear with it, unfortunately. This match... Not really anything special, but not
just set up for Bigelow to get, or for Bulldog to get a win, really.
Yeah, not terrible either. But especially considering just the size of both men, I thought it was a very fast and physical match considering both men's size differences and just the general weight of both men. Both are actually quite agile for their bulk and their size.
We go to Bob Backlund coming out, and they talk about how he's contemplating running for president in 96. And Lawler says that he's just like Colin Powell. He hasn't decided yet. And Colin Powell did not run that next year. It was Bob Dole running against Bill Clinton. Hmm. And spoiler alert, Clinton won. And he cuts this promo on the plebeians. and he introduces someone who crawled out of the cavity and brings out Dean Douglas from the University of Knowledge, which sounds like something sponsored by Scientology. The University of Knowledge.
And sounds like one of those internet scams where you can buy a degree from the University of Knowledge.
Did you read that great article, the fact that Rogers and Telus and Bell, they're all under attack for these misleading third-party companies that are able to charge you without informing you?
I didn't read the article, but I saw you.
Fantastic. I like to say I got the ball rolling.
What does that have to do with the University of Knowledge?
Well, nothing. It's just you mentioned scams, and that instantly came to mind with our iFortune bullshit.
They're brought to task. I think more people should sue these companies.
It's great. I'm glad to hear stuff like that happening in today's society. So this next match was set up. This was Dean Douglas's first pay-per-view match since coming back. I believe he worked the Royal Rumble in 1991, so it wasn't his first WWF pay-per-view, but his first one is Dean Douglas, who he recently signed, leaving ECW, and he had started this feud with Razor Ramon after he graded the ladder match at SummerSlam, and Razor Ramon got so upset he came to his makeshift classroom in the back.
The report card is what his segments used to
be called. The report card. Yeah. And he would basically just run down. It was a kind of clever idea where he'd just get heat by running down opponents by picking apart their wrestling skill.
This was certainly nothing.
That's like what we do.
Yes, yes. I would love to see that. One day. I love to see that gimmick.
Scott Hall walks into our booth.
A gimmick like this, certainly nothing original in pro wrestling. We've seen teacher gimmicks and professor gimmicks all the time. We still see them today.
Matt Stryker did almost this verbatim.
What's his name? Damian Sandow.
Yes, yes. The enlightened heel. So, it led to another attack on television between the two.
This was really their build up to the split between the 1-2-3 Kid and Razor Ramon. I suppose at this time they were both very good friends, coming off of that very memorable match, of course, with the 1-2-3 Kid beating Razor. And since that time, the two had become partners of sorts. And Dean Douglas here really trying to drive up the tension between the two.
Yes, it was the two dudes with bad attitudes here towards each other.
Yeah.
Douglas says he's proud of Bob Backlund and said that if you don't study and prepare, this is a test you will fail, in reference to Razor Ramon preparing for this match. And he continued to run him down.
What a transformation. Sorry to cut you off, but here's Shane Douglas, who came from ECW as the guy who cuts the shoot promo. An ultra realistic gimmick, really. And here he comes into the WWF.
As a teacher.
As a dean, a professor.
Yeah, there was a problem here because we always talk about, some of the best characters are extensions of themselves. And sometimes, I thought Vince McMahon at times would take this stuff way too literally at the time, because I think Shane Douglas, I believe he was like a supply teacher at some point here. I know he was afterwards, this 95 period, but I think he also got involved in teaching. So Vince McMahon hears this and, well, God damn it, he's a teacher. Paul Bearer, a licensed mortician. Damn it. We'll make him Paul Bearer, like a pallbearer. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And
you make his name Dean, like a Dean.
Yeah, alliteration, goddamn.
I think that was their mistake, perhaps. I think if I were to enter the WWE in the mid-90s or even today, I'd probably tell Vince I was a legit, a badass champion.
I'm a world champion.
Yeah.
I'm a supreme fighting machine. So Razor Ramon and Dean Douglas, they wrestle back and forth. Douglas gets thrown to the floor. Cornette's in the back with Yokozuna, this time talking to Mabel, awaiting for their cue. And then they start to speak. This was a little, the director wasn't ready for this, throw to the back. Douglas back flips over and stumbles and gets caught by Ramon for a fallaway slam. Couple of near falls here for Razor Ramon, who then comes back with a shoulder block. He gets tossed to the floor, and Douglas attacks him on the floor, slams him on the mat, hits a knee to the back that sends Ramon into the steps, and then an axe handle off the top, continuing to work over Razor, and works over the lower back. Ramon gets back to his feet, hits an electric chair, and starts his comeback. But then Douglas hits a back elbow while he's seated on the top rope, hits a reverse cross body for a two count, and then Douglas shoves Razor into referee Tim White. Douglas misses with a splash off the second turnbuckle, and Razor hits the Razor's Edge. But Bob Backlund is holding the referee as the 1-2-3 Kid runs in and counts three, but he is not the official.
Why the fuck would he do that?
No idea how this would work in real life. Razor Ramon gets upset because he thinks the 1-2-3 Kid running in is going to get him disqualified. So he shoves Kid out of the ring, and Dean Douglas rolls up Razor, gets the win holding the tights at 14 minutes and 52 seconds. I thought Douglas looked good in this match.
Yeah. This was a decent match between these two.
This is when Douglas had not put on so much weight. He was still very agile in the ring, kind of in his athletic peak.
And Scott Hall as well. Maybe Scott Hall's athletic peak as well. Certainly my favorite period of his career.
And Ramon and Kid then go to fight, and the officials have to separate them. And these two, if memory serves me correctly, they would not have a match on pay-per-view till the following, like, February, I think. So a long time, maybe even after that point. But they held them off for a while here, teasing these two friends going at it. Doc Hendricks is in the back with Shawn Michaels and Diesel, and Doc Hendricks is wearing Shawn Michaels' leather hat and his red glasses. Merchandise ideas at an all-time low in 1995.
You didn't buy one of these hats? Or
no, I did not. I did not buy Shawn Michaels' stripper merch. And Diesel and Michaels... Diesel says he smells a rat amongst Camp Cornette tonight, and says that tonight they are two dudes with attitudes, and after tonight they'll be two chaps with four straps. And they made
that
this sound
so dirty.
It does. It sounded really, really dirty. The Heartbreak Kid and I are going to be two chaps with four straps.
Four straps. That's that's quite a few.
That's a lot of straps for two chaps. Jean-Pierre Lafitte, Carl Ouellette, in the ring, no entrance for the pirate. His gimmick was he stole merchandise from fans, and then he stole Bret Hart's leather jacket and begun wearing it.
Well, he's a pirate. Pirates steal,
yes.
Didn't you know?
This all based on the fact that Carl Ouellette has a glass eye. And so he had a patch.
Was that what that was based on?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
So he had an eye patch here. And Vince McMahon, ABC here, glass eye, patch, pirate. That's how he came up. I bet you his ideas for gimmicks were probably made in less than 10 minutes on average for these guys.
Well, I'm sure it's just whatever he senses. Eh?
Yes, just... not the most creative here.
He's a kid with a box of toys and doesn't care what other people think, really.
He's
obviously
a pirate.
Yeah.
Then we got...
It can't be easy to wrestle with just one eye. You have no depth perception. And, yeah. It can't be easy.
Bret Hart's in the back for what was one of the best Bret Hart promos I've seen in a long, long time.
Well, I like to think of this as kind of being Captain Crook against Captain Crunch, not Captain Crunch, and Pierre Lafitte... He thinks that it's a small thing to steal my jacket, but it's not. A jacket is a jacket, but it's something special to me. And the fact that he's been stealing sunglasses from kids in the front row, the fact that he's a thief in the first place, is enough for me. Pierre Lafitte wants to fancy himself a pirate. When he steps in the ring with me tonight, I think it's time that he walks the plank.
He says, "All right there, Captain Hook. Well, tonight, I'm Captain Crunch." And then calls him Pierre Lafitte. It's time he walks the plank.
Yes.
One of the best interviews of all time.
It's great. It's like, how do you make somebody believe in this gimmick? It's like almost like he gave up. And let's just try to, this is stupid. You're a pirate. I'm going to make pirate puns.
Captain Crunch. Was that the cereal?
Yeah.
I don't understand. I don't understand. What I would take Captain Hook over Captain Crunch in a breakdown.
They all sound ridiculous.
Time to walk in. We got a walk the plank match here with Jean-Pierre Lafitte against Bret Hart with a jacket at stake. And Bret Hart comes down to the ring and he takes the jacket off of Lafitte. And Lafitte comes back with like these weird simultaneous punches with his left and right hand, just hitting him over and over with two hands. And we saw a crucifix pinned by Bret for a two count and worked over the arm of Jean-Pierre. He has the advantage until he misses shoulder first, running into the corner, connects with the post, and then Lafitte throws him into the post again. Lafitte got the advantage, hit a top rope leg drop for a two count, and then he climbs the top again and misses with the cannonball, which was a somersault off the top. Hart gets up, goes for the sharpshooter. Jean-Pierre Lafitte blocks it. And then Lafitte sends Brett to the floor. It goes for a running Tope Con Hilo to the floor, missing Brett and landing onto the floor. Very impressive spot. Carl Ouellette, extremely agile for a big man here.
Yeah.
And having here a match that I'm sure he thought was, you know, his chance to make an impression here, getting to work with one of the top workers in the world here in 1995 in Bret Hart. Hart then comes off the second turnbuckle, but Lafitte gets his foot up. Hart goes for a crucifix, and Lafitte turns it into a rolling fireman's carry. Hart gets sent into the corner after a bulldog attempt, and Lafitte then goes into the ropes, begins selling the knee. They run into each other into the middle, and then both men are on their back, and Hart goes for the sharpshooter off of his back. This was, of course, the finish for the Mr. Perfect match from SummerSlam 91, and Brett locks on the sharpshooter and gets the win. 16 minutes and 35 seconds, and he reclaims his leather jacket and puts it on after the match. And again, Jean-Pierre Lafitte not... had his problems with the click and didn't really last here, but I really enjoyed this match.
I really liked this match too. All of Brett's matches of this era are a lot of fun to watch for me. Not just, you know, because I was a huge fan of his at the time, but because, and you could tell, he tried to get the best out of his opponents no matter who they were at this time. And not to say Jean-Pierre Lafitte is a bad worker by any stretch, but you look at his matches with Yoko and his matches with anybody at this time, and there's a lot of not just technical ability, but creativity thrown into these spots. And anytime you get to see a sharpshooter applied from the ground, I always love that. Jean-Pierre looked great as well, likely one of the best matches of his career. So a very good match that if you're going to watch this show, definitely watch this one.
And as much as 1995 was maybe a creative bottoming out for the company, you had some great talent here on the roster at this point. You had Brett and Sean, who were just on fire at this point in the ring. Even guys like you had Bulldog, you had Owen, you had, Dean Douglas here was, still a very, very capable worker at this point. I mean, it wasn't that the talent so much wasn't there. Sean Waltman. It was just a lot of the creative was not working for people.
Yeah.
It was a really campy part of WWF history and a year that I think a lot of people pan on because it was a very low point for the company. Doc Hendricks is with Cornette and Company in the back and Gorilla Monsoon. Cornette announces that British Bulldog will be the partner of Yokozuna, even though he wrestled earlier tonight. Monsoon sanctions it, and that is our new main event. Diesel and Shawn Michaels against Yokozuna and the British Bulldog. So I would have been fine with Bulldog and Owen here. I mean, that would have been a much, I think, hotter main event than Yokozuna. And I don't really know the reason at this point why they did this. It wasn't like Owen was injured. He actually worked the next night on Raw. I think this was just a way that Bulldog, they wanted to be primed for that big heel spot because he would get the title shot the next pay-per-view. But I think you could have done that and put Owen here unless they just felt that Yokozuna, they wanted in this main event for whatever reason.
The way this match ended, it was... That would it's actually detrimental to pushing Bulldog. This was a loss for the team to set up your guy to get the next title shot. That makes little sense to
me. It was a strange main event. Very hot start with Bulldog and Michaels. Crowd was really into it. And Bulldog is someone that, I mean, he was just such a crisp worker. And I love this mid-90s. You could pair Brett, Sean, Bulldog, and Owen in any combination. And it was just always gold.
Yeah.
I always enjoyed any combination of those four at this time period. It was really just four guys that were just really at the top of their game.
And not even just those guys with each other, but you pair any of those guys with any of the big men at this time. Maybe Kevin Nash aside. But you know what? You put Brett and Nash together, that's a great match too. Sean and Nash together, that's a great match.
When Diesel had the right guy to help him.
But like guys like Yokozuna and... to a much lesser extent, Sid.
Yeah.
It was, they're not
Yokozuna
bad matches,
was just, but... he was so gone at this point. Like, his weight was getting out of control at this point, and it was, there was so little he could do.
But he was still quite agile considering his size, at least in this match.
We got the babyfaces cleared the ring early on. Crowd was really into this, into Diesel and Sean. Bulldog tries for a vertical suplex onto Diesel and drops him, but then did it on a second attempt. One thing that Bulldog as well, I mean, anyone who had followed Bulldog from earlier in his career, especially when he first came over from England over to Stampede, I mean, the guy put on a lot of artificial weight, but was someone that could still work at a high level, even with all this size he had on top of him, which was something that, I mean, is something you typically mortgage when you go for size. Mm. And with Bulldog, I mean, he still worked like a smaller guy, but here a lot of people don't realize how big he was at this point, right, pushing like 280, 290.
And yeah, he did have the speed. He also had the strength as well. At one point in this match, going for attempted to vertical suplex Kevin Nash, didn't work out so well the first time, but he managed to get it a second time, which is a pretty impressive feat on its own when you really, again, compare the size difference.
Michaels, utilizing Kevin Nash for all he was worth, had Kevin just stand in the corner as Michaels balanced himself on his shoulders and delivered a splash onto the Bulldog for a two count. Heels got the heat on Michaels as the ref was distracted with Diesel. Yokozuna misses the bonsai drop onto Michaels, who then makes the hot tag to Diesel, who's in with the Bulldog. And Diesel goes for a powerbomb, but Cornette gets on the apron. Yokozuna stops the powerbomb, hits the worst Samoan drop of all time. Mm. And then
No.
Oh, you're right. Chris Louie gets those honors. Then we saw Michaels hit a super kick to Yokozuna. Bulldog comes back with a power slam to Diesel. Shawn Michaels makes the save, and this is when Owen Hart runs out in his gear, but gets stopped by Diesel. The run-in is thwarted, and he is power-bombed, and they pin Owen Hart at 15 minutes and 46 seconds. This was right out of the strap match from earlier this year with Hulk Hogan and Vader, where Ric Flair was the one who was beat in the finish. Really lazy finish to me. I wasn't a fan of this.
Well, did this play at all into controversy the next day?
The next night, it was ruled Owen Hart was not the sanctioned member, and therefore there was no title change. And that, to me, rubbed me the wrong way. And this is very relevant because this past Sunday, a lot of people were upset about the way they ended the CM Punk-John Cena match in a draw. The fact is, I would have been much more upset if they had gone off the air with John Cena as your WWE champion, only to find out the next night it's reversed. And the fact is, this show was sold on the fact that all the titles are on the line, you're going to see a title change, and you went off the air thinking that we had new tag champions, and instead, to me, this is where a main event leaves the wrong taste in your mouth and regret buying a show, which, up until that finish, I really had enjoyed this show. I think this is a time period where there was still some good wrestling going on, especially on a pay-per-view, which is much less storyline driven. And the next night, it just went right back to Owen and Yokozuna.
I understand from both perspectives. I didn't hate last night's finish at all at Night of Champions. I hate to bring it up again, but like, you look at an MMA fight and look at a draw that you get from a Frankie Edgar in Benson Henderson, for instance, or a Gray Maynard or whatever, and I never feel ripped off because I got to see a great match with a lot of controversy coming out of it. In fact, it makes me more excited to see a rematch. And I don't know if they ever did a rematch.
Yeah, in this case, they weren't building to a rematch here. Right. They went to Diesel and Bulldog at the next pay-per-view. And of course, Sean actually would kind of be written out because he had that whole incident where he was beat up outside the nightclub, and he'd have to vacate his title.
When he lost his smile. How long?
No, this wasn't the smile. That was a different forfeiture.
Oh, right. Okay.
He forfeited a lot of titles.
How long after this pay-per-view was that incident, the Rochester?
It was like a week or two after this, I believe, wow, because it was the October pay-per-view where Michaels had to vacate the title.
Interesting.
So that was In Your House number 3. Overall, I enjoyed this. A, because you had some really good wrestling on the card, especially the undercard. Brett and Jean-Pierre Lafitte, fun little match. Razor Ramon and Dean Douglas, I thought, was fine for what it was. Main event was good. I did not like the finish, but I give this card a good, I'll say 6.5 out of 10. A good show. And 2 hours. A very easily watchable show with a show-long storyline and kind of a period in time that I think a lot of people probably don't focus on too much. But there's some hidden gems in this 1995 period, and we really haven't reviewed much from 95.
No, we haven't. For me personally, the characters and the matches of this era are personal nostalgic favorite of mine, so my viewing is slightly skewed. When you really look at it, though, it's there are really only two matches worth watching on this card, and that would be the Brett and the Sean Bulldog match at the end. So I give this also a 6. I didn't really quite understand the show-long storyline with Owen, replacing Owen here.
Yeah, it was kind of strange because I guess they wanted Bulldog in there with Diesel, but to me, it's almost like, I don't know what the politics were like at that point, but it would have made more sense that Bulldog got some kind of heat on Diesel going off of this show. Yeah. Even like if the heels had like teased winning and then you tune into Raw to see what happened. I mean, you probably could have crafted a better idea where Bulldog got some false finish on Diesel and the controversy is if Bulldog had won the title leading to a rematch at the next pay-per-view. Mm-hmm. This really didn't do anything for Diesel Bulldog. So
sure, there is some story backstage.
I don't doubt that at all. So let's head into your feedback now for those of you that checked it out and this pay-per-view did somehow make its way onto YouTube and was not confiscated by the WWE during their blitz of online piracy this past week, where they are removing all questionable content from their library.
What would you say would be the most questionable aspect of this show? For a very tame product at this
point. Oh, yeah, 95. They certainly weren't upsetting too many people, I don't feel, in 95. Geez, nothing comes to mind, really, for me.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I find it, not to go on a tangent here, but I do find it somewhat silly at the end of its day that, you know, Linda McMahon, I understand, is going to get a lot of flack during this whole campaign, and it's only going to heat up leading into November. But when it comes to content on a show, I don't know. It's like I understand that argument that back in the Attitude Era, there was a lot of children tuning in, and you can argue about being responsible broadcasters. At the same time, it's like if Linda was like a movie producer, I don't think she would come under half the criticism she does. That wrestling always falls into this weird area. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I just find it. It's like, okay, yeah, if you're going to get on somebody for this content, I don't think Linda McMahon is the target here. She was not the creative person here. She was not green lighting these angles or coming up with these ideas. She was strictly on the business side. And if you want to criticize the business side of it, fine. She's running on that idea that she's created all these jobs. And when it comes to, you know, Trish barking like a dog, I think you're barking up the wrong tree.
Oh.
All right. Let's head to the feedback. Way, why don't you start us off?
I will do that. And we go to, if you give me 1 second here.
Okay, I'll go first. Andrew Sheehy. Smart choice for a review this week. The year 1995 has got to be the worst year in the history of WWF/E, as the roster was thin and business was at an all-time low. This show is one example of the company at rock bottom. The opening match between Waylon Mercy and Savio Vega was meaningless. This turned out to be the only pay-per-view match for Dan Spivey in the WWF, as he got injured weeks later. He actually did work the Battle Royal at WrestleMania 2, so he had been on a pay-per-view prior. Godwin-Sid was your typical big man match that was forgotten the next day. Razor Ramon, Deed, and Douglas match was okay, with the man who called Ric Flair Dick Flair in ECW getting the win. It's too bad the politics cut the franchise's tenure in the company short. Bret Hart, Jean-Pierre Lafitte was surprisingly good. It shows you that Bret can have a good match with anyone at any given time during this era. Finally, the tag match for all three titles between Diesel, HBK, and Bulldog Yokozuna was okay, but the WWF title should have changed hands here. It would have been great if the Bulldog took the title from Diesel, but it wasn't meant to be. Mediocre show, 4 out of 10. I thought Jean-Pierre Lafitte, I didn't think he was incapable at all. I thought he was a very good big man at this spot, and you know, could have been used a lot better, and especially when he was in there with a guy like Brett, that got accentuated.
It wasn't exactly a big man. He was short, but like, you know,
but a big guy. I mean, he was pushing over 300.
Zach Volk, completely disagree with the opinion that 95 was the worst year in history. The early part of 95 was poor, but from September on, the Monday Night Wars had kicked off and things were starting to get on the upswing. The weeks prior to this pay-per-view, Bischoff had recently signed Lex out from under Vince and was revealing Raw match results on Nitro tapings. They're definitely changing the world of wrestling. The WWF tag titles were prestigious enough to be involved in the main event. Imagine that. The gimmick of the match was fun for me as a kid watching live, and I really thought anything could happen. In my opinion, Bret had some really strong matches in 95 with Hakushi, Diesel, Bulldog, and yes, Lafitte. Lafitte is maligned due to the pirate gimmick, but for a bigger guy, he moved well, had a strong moveset, and was believable in the ring. As for the pirate gimmick, it wasn't that bad. The character was supposed to be an homage to his ancestors. 94, wow, so how appropriate. He had ancestors and also a glass eye. 2012 Vince would probably have had Lafitte do a dance number and have a parrot. Bret versus Lafitte was the match of the night for me. I imagine people will crap on this show as mediocre or worse, but as a kid, ordering this for $15 and getting five solid matches
was five solid matches. I think you're being a little generous there.
Was a great value. In your houses were what B shows should be to me, cheaper and advancing storylines building to the big shows. The format of trying to deliver a show and charge roughly the same amount at every pay-per-view doesn't work. It just makes it seem like you've seen every pairing a million times because you probably have. I give it a 6 out of 10. I don't know if that's possible today because essentially every Raw is a B show of this level.
Yeah, a completely different business model today. And, I mean, yeah, $14.95 pay-per-views were fun, but they were also viewed at a secondary level. And it was really... Something that had a huge help in the company's turnaround was in 97 when they increased those pay-per-views to 3 hours and made them $30 like the other pay-per-views, and they found out that the price increase really didn't hurt numbers. The people spending 15, they were willing to spend 30 on them.
There was also much more demand for the product at this
yep,
time.
That helped that a lot time. Too. So, and I think 95, I mean, yeah, it was maybe getting interesting with Nitro coming on and stuff, but both companies, to me, were at a creative low in 95. Even with the advent of Nitro and it was getting more interesting to be a wrestling fan, I would say the WWF really did not react to Nitro until, I would say, like a year later. It was, I mean, they were very slow to react. And I think 95 is, you know, not a creative bastion for the company. Pat from Atlanta writes, last year I went back and watched all of the pay-per-views from 1995. In Your House 3 was pretty bad. If I recall, Bret and Jean-Pierre Lafitte feuded because Jean-Pierre stole Bret's jacket. Riveting. Shawn and Diesel were called the two dudes with attitudes, which was meant to sound cool. Far from it. The finish to their match made no sense. Waylon Mercy was on this card. He had interesting vignettes, but Dan Spivey was past his prime by 95. His character look and voice borrowed heavily from Robert De Niro's take on Max Caddy from the Cape Fear remake. Dean Douglas was a bad use of Shane Douglas. Someone actually booked a pay-per-view match between Psycho Sid and Henry O. Godwin. This is an obscure, forgotten pay-per-view during one of the WWE's weakest years. 4 out of 10.
Our next piece of feedback, and this person says, last year I went back and watched all the...
I read that.
Oh, you just read that. Sorry.
Corey Ferreira.
From Corey Ferreira, who says, this was around the time the WWF started to get a lot better from the awful start to 95 they had. The Bret Hart match on this show is quite good, but no one will see it or know it exists. I blame the fact he was wrestling a damn pirate. The idea of doing all the major belts on the line in the main event is a good idea. Anyone with a brain can tell Shawn and Nash were walking out with the tag belt. The match is okay, but nothing more. I think this is one of the more solid In Your House shows from 95. I think Vince knew he had to up his game around this time because of the looming WCW threat, seeing they had just launched Nitro.
Go to Christian Small. This show just screamed quintessential B show to me. I don't have a clue what the opening theme was about. That was a truly odd choice. All I took from the opening match was Savio has a hand shaved into his hair. Mercy looks like a balding, clean-shaven Bryan Adams. It was truly awkward, and I thought Mercy killed Savio with that botched suplex. Correct me if I'm wrong, but did Ross use Slobber Knocker for the first time on this show? King and Vince sounded shocked when it came out of his mouth. The Backlund promo was weird and seemed nervous throughout. The match afterwards wasn't much better, and the best worker out of the whole thing was the 1-2-3 kid. Whoever suggested Douglas be a high flyer should have been fired, as 85% of it looked awful. I truly think that Bret and Jean-Pierre Lafitte was the match of the show. Bret could make anyone look great, although he almost killed himself that opening dive, and I couldn't help but cringe when Jean-Pierre Lafitte missed that plancha on the floor. The tag match was okay, not much more. It got great crowd heat, but the action was meh. And like most things, it was pretty meaningless, as the next night the decision would be reversed, and the Smoking Guns would win the tag titles against Yokozuna and Owen Hart. Which reminds me, why replace Owen? The team of Owen and Bulldog would have done a lot more there. Overall, I thought the saving grace was the Bret-Jean-Pierre Lafitte match and Jim Cornette, who I just loved throughout the entire show. One final thing, I have a question for John, if it hasn't already been covered. Was Jean-Pierre's eye patch legit? I remember him still wearing it when the Quebecers reformed in 98. I imagine it would be hard to work with, and you could have done the gimmick without the patch. I'd give the show a 4 out of 10, thought it easily missed this show, and I would have been fine. No, he did have a glass eye. He did work without the patch for a time as well, in his earlier Quebecers team with Jacques Rougeau. But yeah, he's a pirate. Makes sense to have the patch.
From Darcy, who says, WWF In Your House 3 should have been titled Beware of the Dusty Finish. I love the concept of the WWF champion and IC champion challenging for the tag team championships, and all the titles are on the line. It's awful that the tag titles didn't change hands because the Bulldog replaced Yoko and Bulldog was the one who took the fall. Instead of,
it was Owen who took the fall.
Owen who took the fall. I love Michaels and Diesel back in 95. It was the heartbreak kid that got me into professional wrestling. No matter if he was a face or heel, that might be another reason why to this day, almost 20 years later, I'm still bitter over the finish of this pay-per-view.
All right, it's time to move on. It's okay.
Back to the main event title match. I feel the WWE did a great job with that in Backlash 2001, where Steve Austin and IC champ Triple H defeated the WWF tag champions The Undertaker and Kane for the belts. The two-man power trip were great as the tag champs and holding the top two singles belts for a few weeks. Maybe Backlash 2001 would be a great review if you guys haven't.
All right, we go to Yes, I Am a Duck. This was the first WWF VHS I remember owning, and I watched it a lot as a kid. It was pretty terrible, wasn't it? The card was just full of filler, and the whole tag swerve was all kinds of bullshit and not a worthy main event of any show ever in the history of anything that has ever been held. I like the guy that had the worm. Don't remember who he was, but I don't remember seeing him before and after the match. The guy that had the worm?
Waylon Mercy. He squashed the worm.
Oh, yeah. I'm thinking of, like, doing the worm in the ring. Also, I didn't care about Savio Vega then or any other time in my life. This product was very cold at the time. I watched this video obsessively as a kid, and despite this fact, I still barely remember anything. 3 out of 10.
Finally, from Mike Michaels, who...
no relation.
Writes a dissertation here about this pay-per-view.
Just pick out the highlights if you want.
If you care to read it all, please go lawradio.proboards.com. He says, I love 1995 WWF and I love this pay-per-view. 95 gets a lot of criticism for how cartoonish much of the product was in both major companies, but I find that the shit characters only deserve to emphasize how great the big stars are. Diesel and Shawn are a perfect example of this. Two guys who would get over in any era in the roles they played as both heels and faces, but look even more like megastars when they're stuck on the same card as Henry Godwin or a Savio Vega. It helps when the guys are great workers too, of course, which all of the guys in the main event were. Nash and Yoko played their big man in the corner role well. Bulldog was in the form of his life, and Shawn Michaels effortlessly stole the show as usual. That opening three-quarter minutes of the match is the kind of thing HBK would do every week in every match just to really outshine everybody else. Further to that, Brett spent all of 95 buried against a revolving cast of losers and repeatedly brought some amazing matches to the table. This match with Pierre was awesome and wasn't even the best of their series if you've ever had a chance to catch one of their matches tacked onto the In Your House 2 VHS. Anyway, like most of the In Your House events before they went to 3 hours, this was a breeze to sit through and featured more good moments than bad.
All right, that's going to wrap up our feedback. So thanks to everyone for posting up at the Law Message Board. Every week we put up a thread of whatever review we are going to be doing, usually posted around Friday. And you can always post your feedback there as well. Immediately after Raw and Impact, we post threads there. And you can leave your feedback and be heard on the podcast. So that brings us an end to the show. In Your House 3 is in the books. And now we look ahead to next week, Way. And I was trying to think of something... worthwhile to review. I wanted to keep on the September theme, this being September, and thought we could review a fall brawl event, but I'm going to let you pick the year. Somewhere between 95 and 90, let's do between 95 and 98, because those all had War Games events that the show was known
between
for.
95 and 98.
So you pick a year.
All right, I will pick the year that my birth nation of Hong Kong was returned to the Republic of China. That would be 1997.
97. All right. This will be a fun one to go back and check because this was really when the company was at a real hot point. It was just a few months before that huge Starcade with Hogan and Sting. And we will go back and review Fall Brawl 97 from wherever it took place, headlined by whatever. I think it was a Team WCW, Team NWO. Main event. So that is going to be our review for next week.
Maybe Kevin Nash will be making an appearance on this.
I believe he was on that show. So lots of Kevin.
Let's quickly look it up just so we don't get people
upset.
to, well, just so we can do the, I'm just curious myself. I got it. Okay. We got Chris Jericho versus Eddie Guerrero, Steiners versus Harlem Heat, Alex Wright taking on the Ultimo Dragon, Dean Malenko taking on Jeff Jarrett, the Giant makes an appearance, and the main event features the Four Horsemen taking on the NWO.
That's right.
Wonderful. In a War Games match. Awesome.
Okay, so next week, Fall Brawl 97 will be the review. In the meantime, you can go check out liveaudiowrestling.com. You can follow myself and Way on Twitter, at Law Radio, at Way, WAI0937. And if you're in Canada, we've got a very, very busy week here on the Fight Network with all of the UFC 152 coverage we're going to be doing. If you're listening to this on Wednesday, we're going to be live every day on the channel. If you look up Fight News Now Extra, just look it up on the guide. Myself, John Ramsey, and Robin Black will be doing lots of live programming. And then Thursday, we're going to be doing a studio analysis pre and post for the press conference. Friday with the weigh-ins. That weigh will be at, right? You're going to Maple Leaf Gardens on Friday?
Yes, I will be weighing in.
You will be weighing in on the weigh-in.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Saturday is UFC 152, and we will be live on the network immediately after the main event between Jon Jones and Vitor Belfort. So a very, very busy week, but never too busy to not sit down and review 1995 wrestling.
Or any wrestling that takes place. Also, a quick plug here for the Fight Network. The new app is available for all you smartphone users. Just type in Fight Network at the App Store or whatever Android users use. And a great feature of it is that you can download our show and stream a lot of our shows very easily. So check that alternative out if you guys don't use whatever Stitcher or the podcast app.
Lots of ways to listen to the show. So yeah, you can download that. It's got all the Law Daily updates, podcasts, lots of stuff. So just go in the App Store, download the Fight Network app for free. Yet another way to hear all of us. So I thought let's finish off here, Wei. Do you want to hear Psy?
No.
No, you don't. Okay. It's Gangnam Style.
Okay.
Gangnam Style. What would you like to hear going out here, Wei?
You play whatever you want. It's your choice.
Well, Wei, I think it's only fair then that we wrap up the Gangnam Style phenomenon here so people can hear it at home.
That's fine.
From Psy.
Okay.
And Wei gives us a sigh of relief.
Gangnam Style. Gangnam Style. Op, 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 op. Oppan Gangnam Style. Gangnam Style. Op, 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 op. Oppan Gangnam Style. Hey, sexy lady. Op, 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 op. Oppan Gangnam Style. Hey, sexy lady. Op, 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 op. 정숙해 보이지만 볼 땐 노는 여자. 이때다 싶으면 묶었던 머리 푸는 여자. 가렸지만 웬만한 노출보다 야한 여자. 그런 감각적인 여자. 나는 선어해. 점잖아 보이지만 놀 땐 노는 선어해. 내가 되면 완전 미쳐버리는 선어해. 근육보다 사상이 울퉁불퉁한 선어해. 그런 선어해. 아름다워 사랑스러워. Oppan Gangnam Style.
Gangnam Style.